member of the Philadelphia Society. I practice law in Gary, Indiana. In Chicago, Illinois. I was born in Gary, Indiana. More of which in a moment. But I'm sitting here with our luncheon speaker, James Otteson, and David Sturr, the treasurer of the society. And although David and I promise you there's no memorandum whatsoever, no memo. Last night, David was wearing his blue Harry Langenberg Memorial Adam Smith bow tie. And this morning, we are both wearing our maroon Harry Langenberg Memorial bow ties. And this led to a robust discussion just now of Adam Smith ties. And so I'm doing something incredibly self-indulgent. I'm beginning the program 5 minutes early because I have to tell you something about Adam Smith ties. You're going to think for a moment that I am channeling Barack Obama, because the first few things I'm going to say are incredibly self-referential. And self-indulgent. This is about me. This very day is my birthday, the 24th of October. Thank you. That was highly appropriate, and deeply appreciated. I'm a child of the Philadelphia Society, and from about the time of my very first attendance at a meeting of the Philadelphia Society, which was at the Drake Hotel in Chicago in 1971, brought there by my teacher, Milton Friedman, a founder and life member of this society. I have been intrigued, of course, with Adam Smith, and when Don and Norma Lipsett brought forth to the world the Adam Smith tie, I, of course, acquired mine. Now, in those days, I wore neckties. My late father, a lawyer in Gary, Indiana, hence the error a moment ago, was a lifelong bow tie guy. And when I was a little boy, as we were talking here at the table, my parents would dress me up and they would make me wear a clip-on bow tie, which I just hated. And when I was old enough to rebel, which was not very old, I insisted on not wearing a clip-on bow tie, but tying my own necktie, and I wanted a necktie so I looked different from my father. And I wore neckties my life, including joining the Philadelphia Society, acquiring Adam Smith neckties from the Decatur shop of Don and Norma Lipsett. And then, alas, when I was in law school at the University of Chicago, my father passed away. And I inherited from my father about 100 tie-yourself bow ties, and I put them carefully aside in a shelf. And one day, about a year after my father died, I woke up in the morning with this tremendous urge, this need to wear a bow tie. And from that day until this, I have worn naught but bow ties, save on three occasions. And it was recounting those three occasions in 35 years that made me realize this is the anniversary of one of them. One occasion was when I was a member of a wedding party, and the bride insisted that all the men dress alike in morning clothes. And although I assured her that there's a bow tie made for morning clothes, she wanted us all to look alike in the photographs. And on her wedding day, every bride is a queen, a Jewish tradition teaches us. And so I obeyed, and I wore the Windsor tie. The second occasion was truly bizarre. My wife Kathy and I were on a cruise in the Caribbean under the watchful eye of Phil Hughes. And we put down in Nassau in the Bahamas, and I'm wearing... this will help destroy your appetite if you haven't finished eating. I'm wearing a pink polo shirt and white shorts. And Kathy is strolling, and I am waddling around downtown Nassau. And we come to the two-story white clapboard building that is the Bahamian Parliament House, and there's a sign in front of it that says, Budget Day Today. And I thought, this is so cool. Parliament is sitting. We cannot not, we cannot be in Nassau and not go to see the Bahamian Parliament sit. So we walk in, and we're on our way into the Parliament chamber, and we're stopped by a sergeant at arms. very imposing fellow who says, "I'm sorry, sir, but you don't comport with the dress code." And I look at myself and I say, "Well, you're right, obviously not." And I turn to walk away, and he, "Psh, come with me," he says. And I follow him to a cloakroom around the corner, and it turns out that I am violating the dress code not by this ridiculous pink polo shirt or the even more ridiculous white shorts, but I'm not wearing a tie. So he undoes his own necktie. I put his necktie on over my polo shirt, and now I am qualified to enter Parliament. So Kathy and I went in, and we sat and saw Lyndon Pindling, if you remember him, and his cabinet presenting the Bahamian budget, and the mathematics were far more intelligible than those of the current administration. But the third occasion was 25 years ago today. It was October 24, 1984. It was just a week or two ahead of President Reagan's re-election that year. And those of you who know me well recall that in those days I worked for President Reagan and for a fellow member of the society who's not here today, Don Devine. Don was then the director and I was the general counsel of the United States Office of Personnel Management, the civil service. We ran the civil service for President Reagan. And I had a standing weekly meeting of my staff, of the lawyers of the Office of General Counsel. About 50 of us would meet in a big conference room. And it was usually, my recollection, it was a Wednesday morning. It was always Wednesday mornings. And so I'm walking down the hall on my way to the conference room, and I'm running a little late, and there's a crack in the door, and I look through the door, and I see everybody's already in there, and I see in the corner, aha, they've got a birthday cake. But everybody in the room was wearing a bow tie. So I, okay, my staff is sucking up, and this is good. So by the way, I should add that by this point, throughout the Reagan years, you will recall there are photographs. Eric Brodin took photographs of Philadelphia Society meetings in those areas. I'm usually wearing an Adam Smith bow tie. Don Devine, Ed Meese are usually wearing Adam Smith neckties. I'm the guy in the Adam Smith bow tie. Now, those ties all came from Don and Norma and the Decatur shop, but it was a long time coming before we got bow ties, and guys like David Sturr and the late Harry Langenberg of St. Louis, longtime member, founder of the St. Louis Discussion Club and so forth, and I were clamoring, lobbying for bow ties. And so finally Norma parted with two bolts of cloth, one blue and one maroon, and Harry Langenberg, God bless him, had a tie maker in St. Louis who made bow ties, and that's where David Sturr's tie comes from and my tie. And I have only four. I've had them now well over a quarter of a century. I used to wear them daily. Now to preserve them, I wear them only on state occasions, such as today. But so I went back to my office, and I had in a drawer in my desk an Adam Smith necktie from the Decatur shop that I had bought to give to someone as a gift. So I whipped off my Adam Smith bow tie, I put on my Adam Smith necktie, and I came down the hall and walked into the conference, and they're all in bow ties, and I'm in a necktie. And we all laughed. Thank you very much. That was 25 years ago today. Now, the Decatur shop, alas, of course, no longer exists, but the tradition of the Adam Smith bow tie has been picked up by the Honorable Morton Blackwell, Master of Arts, as of last night. And now you know the art of which he's a master. He picked up the Adam Smith tie-making business for Leadership Institute. And I think the Adam Smith Institute in London also produces an Adam Smith tie and so forth. So there are many Adam Smith, many designs, both the men's and women's varieties around the room. But insofar as David Sturr and I are aware, the only Adam Smith bow ties that exist on Earth are those that come from Harry Langenberg, from that long ago day. So a note to entrepreneurs, there is a market if the opportunity presents itself. Thank you for indulging me, and let's hope that the Barack Obama moment is over. Apparently not. As I said, I was born in Gary, Indiana, which is why last night's dinner, when Ed Fulner asked all of the members of the society from Indiana, stood up. Most of you think associate me with Chicago corruption, understandably. But no, actually, I am from Gary, Indiana. I was born and reared there. While I appreciate that other Hoosiers in the room are not always sure that those of us from the Calumet region, as it's called, are actually from Indiana, I assure you that we are. And in fact, today, just this morning, there's huge news coming in from Gary, Indiana. There was an earthquake there overnight. It registered 4.6 on the Richter scale and did $6.3 billion worth of improvements. It was a sad moment for us Garyites earlier this year when one of our number, the third member of the Modern Trinity, Oprah, Obama, and Michael Jackson, passed away. And with the death of Michael Jackson, that leaves me as the last white guy from Gary, Indiana. I am a Jewish American, which normally I would not trot out my faith, but I do at today's occasion for reasons which will become apparent momentarily. I am married to a Roman Catholic. Kathy is a Roman Catholic, and she is a very active and practicing Roman Catholic. I'm a very active and practicing Jew. We're both deeply involved in the institutional structures of our various religious faiths, and this makes for a very interesting life. Our friend, Francis Cardinal George, the Archbishop of Chicago, once publicly said, "Other people talk about Jewish-Christian dialogue, the Morrises live it." I have lots of friends who are rabbis, lots of friends who are priests, lots of friends who are ministers, too, but I'm going to omit them for the moment. One pair that I know, a small town, Midwest American town, rabbi and priest presided over congregations that happened to be located on the same block. Synagogue at one end of the block, Catholic church at the other end of the block, and the two rectories were side by side in the middle of the block. And in hard economic times, these two fellows were talking about, you know, their financial problems of their respective congregations and how they could save money. And so they came up with a brilliant idea. They noticed that between the two of them, they only needed one car. And each had an old clunker, and each needed a new car, and they entered into an agreement under which they would both buy one car and just share it as needed. So they went out and shopped, found a good deal, bought the car, brought it back, you know, sort of this joint investment. And the rabbi is then sitting in his study the day they bought the car, and he sees the car parked out in the street in front of the two rectories. And here comes the priest from next door, you know, kind of just quietly sneaking out to the car. And he's got an asperger, that's a thing that dispenses holy water. And he's dispensing holy water on the car. And the rabbi's like, "Yeah, he's baptizing our car, the sneak." So a little while later, Father McGuire is sitting in his study. He looks out the window, and he sees the rabbi sneaking out to the car with a little hands-on. He cuts about a half inch off the tailpipe. I'm a child as well of the University of Chicago, once defined as a Baptist institution where Marxist professors taught Thomistic philosophy to Jewish students. As I have said, it was Milton Friedman who took me to my first meeting of the Philadelphia Society at the Drake, and I met for the first time at that first meeting the late, great Ben Rogge. Those of you who knew Ben Rogge knew that he was fond of, I mean, he was a Renaissance man, and one of his remarkable attributes was an amazing ability to play billiards, play pool. And so the question came up, is there some place where I could play pool here in Chicago? And of course there was. It was the Quadrangle Club down at the University of Chicago. So we took him there. And Ben, who was nothing if not a colorful fellow, was off his game that night. And as he took his cue and aimed at the cue ball hit another ball, spun off in a direction Ben did not intend, and went right into a pocket. And Ben said, "Oh, fudge." And another shot, a bad break. And Ben said, "Oh, shucks." And I noticed in the corner there was this very wide-eyed little boy at the Quadrangle Club who was the cue boy and the racker. And he was just taking in everything that Ben Rogge said and did. Ben was such a natural teacher. And he was particularly taking in, you know, all these epithets. And before the little boy left, I gave him a tip. And I said, "Little boy, what's your name?" He said, "Rahm Emanuel." So now you know. But But that's that. Let me hasten to say that that story is untrue. Rahm Emanuel did not learn his vocabulary from Ben Rogge. In fact, the Emanuel family will tell you that Rahm Emanuel's first words, it was a four-syllable word, and the first two were mother. The University of Chicago today, however, I'm afraid, is not exactly. Please keep the coffees. Don't mind me. Keep the coffee service coming. We will get to James Otteson, I promise. University of Chicago today is not what it was in Friedman's day. I have to tell you that the fellow who currently holds the Obama chair in astronomy, conferred with the fellow who holds the Obama chair in New Testament, and they came to the conclusion that this gospel reference to a star in the heavens was actually around 1960 over Hawaii. And meanwhile, the Assyrian Dictionary Project, the Sumerian Dictionary Project, is really moving apace. Editor holds the Obama chair in ancient Near Eastern languages. And they just announced, and I this is really going to make Alan Russell unhappy, but it turns out that this little cuneiform symbol here in Sumerian does not mean freedom at all. It means hope and change. Speaking of publications, I learned from John Basil Utley just at this meeting, and I'm not making this up, that the American Conservative magazine, which many of us read and love, is now officially a not-for-profit organization. Thus confirming what many of us had suspected for some time. I do have some other news that I am enjoined to bring to you about members of the Philadelphia Society. Warren Coates, also University of Chicago man, by the way, just elected to, I think, his third term on the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority. This is the central bank of the Cayman Islands. I'm not making that up. And they are the most respected and brilliant central bank on earth. They meet once a quarter, and the first thing they do every quarter is they adopt the United States dollar as their currency. The second thing they do then is make sure that the neon light in the window is plugged in. It flashes the sign, Cayman Islands Central Bank, you're on your own. And then the third thing they do is adjourn and go to the beach. And Ron Paul, finding out about this, has introduced legislation that would adopt the Cayman Islands method for the American Federal Reserve. It's called the Son of a Beach plan for the Federal Reserve. Jane Shaw, earlier today, was kind enough to walk us through the intricacies of nomenclature in the Shavian household. That really was a very clever play on her part to announce the latest production of a Shavian play, She Stroops to Conquer. Okay. All right, you're entitled to one. I really learned something today from Thor Halvorsen. It came as a shock to my Chicago sensibilities. If you were in that wonderful session, you heard Thor say that the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The second best time to plant a tree is today. Not if you're from Chicago. The best time to plant a tree in Chicago is when the mayor's brother-in-law has the tree contract. In that spirit, by the way, I have an important note. Some of you paid a lot of money to get here from the airport, and you're looking to pay a lot of money to get back to the airport. But my cousin Ed, the above and beyond limousine service has a desk downstairs in the lobby of this hotel. This is not a joke. The Above and Beyond Limousine Service has a desk downstairs in the lobby. They have a deal with the society for people going to the airport. They'll be taking reservations until 7 o'clock tonight, and the cost per person to from here to the airport tonight or tomorrow, whenever you're going, is $20.40. So Julie wanted me to let you know that that tremendous bargain is available. The Above and Beyond limo service in the lobby of this hotel, $20.40. My cousin Ed. One other member of our society who really produced something of amazing triumph this year is Joe Bast, the president of the Heartland Institute, which has a big, I think it's the 30th anniversary of the Institute coming up in just a couple of weeks. But early, how many?
25.
You look older, John. It's the beard. Earlier this year, Heartland Institute held an amazing conference on climate change, their second annual conference on climate change in New York. Doing a shocking thing, spreading truth. Kathy and I were in Dubai. We were in an airport in Dubai while that conference was going on. We're waiting to get our bags, and they have these newfangled TV screens. So while you're waiting to get your bags, you can be entertained. I mean, never a moment to be left with thoughts anywhere on the globe anymore. And on the screen is a British Sky News report coming from Joe's conference in New York. And we're standing there watching a friend of this society, Václav Klaus, president of the Czech Republic, who was one of the keynote speakers at Joe's conference, speaking, and he's got the crowd roaring, and he's got them in the palm of his hand, and he's saying fantastic things. And while we're waiting for our bags, we see the following interchange. Some student or somebody calls out to Klaus and says, "You should run for president of the United States." And I am not making this up. At Joe Bast's conference, Václav Klaus, head of state of the sovereign Czech Republic, answers, "Well, I would be glad to if you can get me a Hawaiian birth certificate." Now, Bill Campbell had suggested that I speak a little bit about the theme of American exceptionalism. I won't. I've been self-indulgent enough. Let me turn instead to main speaker of the luncheon. One of the reasons why I was pointing out that I'm Jewish is I was going to note that our speaker is a professor at Yeshiva University. And if you want to look at a classic model of Jewish physiognomy, I mean, behold, the Aryan Jew. James Otteson and I have a lot in common. We grew up in the Belt around Chicago. He is a son of Joliet, Illinois. Joliet Catholic High School, went from there to Notre Dame University, undergraduate student there, took a master's degree at the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee, and then came to the University of Chicago, for a master's degree and a PhD in philosophy. His dissertation was on moral sentiments and Adam Smith. Since then, he's become a teacher, and he has taught at the University of Alabama. He has taught at Georgetown, and now he teaches at Yeshiva. How's that for an academic trifecta? He has published, or rather he has written, and Cambridge University Press has published two splendid books on the thought and work of the man who graces the ties of many of us, whose face graces the ties of many of us in the room, Adam Smith. The first book, published in 2002, by Cambridge, was Adam Smith and the Marketplace of Life, in which he works out a brilliant reconciliation or coherent presentation of what work is going on in Wealth of Nations and what's going on in Smith's theory of moral sentiments. In 2006, he published Actual Ethics, which then in 2007 won the Templeton Book Prize. He now teaches both economics and philosophy at the nation's only Orthodox Jewish institution, a degree-granting institution, non-seminary degree-granting institution of higher education, Yeshiva University in New York. It is a real pleasure and privilege to present to this body truly one of the world's greatest living experts on the thought, both economic and moral, of Adam Smith, James Otteson.